also, the dog is under reconstruction. So there may be some mistakes, and I keep changing things from time to time. So I'm going to show you the what's on today in this course of reconstruction. So, well, motives and strengths. So then the question may be, what is a motive? Well, a motive is something which has, I want to keep it a vague notion. I am not going to give a definition. But it's like this talk, it has a realization, various realizations. There's a spoken realization of this talk, and there is a transparency realization of the talk. And the two are quite closely related, but not the same. So while you're reading the transparency, I can say other things about what's the motive. So I think we should, a motive is a sort of, basically it's a feeling. There's something and you're observing it. And mathematicians like to use, for their observations and measurements, they like to use cohomology. And it's like physicists, you can observe things in different wavelengths, or from the mathematical point of view, you can use different time numbers, or you can use complex numbers, and things like that. And all these cohomologies theories give some idea of what's going on behind the screen, but you only see what is on the screen. And on the screen you see common patterns. And so basically motives is about how to understand these common patterns and hopefully have an idea of what is behind the screen, what you're actually observing. So the prototype of a motive is a variety. And I want varieties to be defined over a, let's say for the moment, defined over a field of characteristic zero. And but I do allow positive transcendence degree. And now I'm going to observe these varieties, and the reason for not sticking to a real definition of what is a motive, I think what we have at the moment is a bit limited in the formulation of what a motive would be. I think we should be open-minded even to go along with the physicists who have many more kinds of geometry available than the algebraic geometers. And maybe at certain stages we should also bring in these other geometries into the various realization of what is a motive. So in this case, we can sort of observe our variety by embedding our field K into, let's say, the complex numbers. Or we can embed K into a p-adic field. And I like to think of this as choosing the type of analysis which you're also going to use. Are you going to use complex analysis, or are you going to use p-adic analysis? So I think that it's not a common type of formulation of what the motive is, but I think realizing in your mind thinking that it's also important that you know which type of analysis are you using. So depending on that, you apply cohomology, you will see either the standard cohomology things about complex varieties that includes also classical topology, or called Betti realizations. Or you will see cohomology theories which work over p-adic numbers, and those are what one calls crystalline cohomologies. And if the field has positive transcendence degree, you can also think that that's very clear in the complex embeddings, that actually what you are looking at is a family of varieties parameterized by this embedding. And if you change things, cohomology will slightly change. And so what you get, for instance, is a variation of Hodge structure in the complex case. And while a very practical down-to-earth things, it's going to be controlled by differential equations, Picard-Fuchs differential equations. And also roughly, the crystalline cohomology is like that. Crystalline cohomology is a theory about differential forms, a theory about differentiation. It's close to analysis. And it has one difference with complex theory is that in characteristic P, you have this Frobenius operator. So this Frobenius operator is also around in all these differential equations. And that's going to be an important part of the structure. So when I'm vague about what is a motive, if I have my motive in the crystalline realization, there is also somewhere Frobenius around. Okay, so motives is also about the common theme, the comparison between these various realizations. And I think it's one of the shortcomings of motive theory at the moment is that there's no clear picture. There is a crystalline realization of every prime number P. But how do these different P's, how do they match up? So, and somehow that's in the back of my mind with all this thing, is to try to find out how can I sort of make all these, also compare the different kinds of p-adic analysis, different times p. Okay. So, well, I think that there should be a relation between motives and strings. Well, to my feeling, both theories are sort of vague. They are built on feelings, intuition, and so on. And if you ask for examples to show what intuition you're actually having, then it turns out that the physicists and the mathematicians come up with differential equations, and they come up with very closely related or even the same differential equations. And then physicists, they want to manipulate solutions of these differential equations. And if you look at them, if you look at what's happening, you will see solutions, whether rational power series solutions, whether rational numbers as coefficients, are really denominators. But after a lot of manipulations, all of a sudden, and by some mystery, these denominators drop out and the coefficients become integers. The crystalline theories, which can deal with these differential equations, they can somehow tell a bit why you get, after all these manipulations, integers. There are theorems in crystalline cohomology, mainly the theorem of Maeser and Ogus, which tells you how the eigenvalues of Frobenius are related to the Hodge structure. And that's very concretely that certain numbers are divisible by certain powers of prime being. And well, you can try to apply those theorems. And then it turns out that you get an idea why these integers are p-adic integers, why they do not have a denominator which is divisible by p. That can be explained in this crystalline theory. But this explanation does involve also certain normalizations. And one of the frustrations I saw years ago, I thought, well, maybe that's the reason to explain why these numbers are integers in the physics literature and tables. They realized that I couldn't get the normalizations for the different primes to work together. So that's sort of my, again, it's a problem in the back of my mind. I want a mechanism to get all these primes to work together, to explain why I do not only get p-adic integers for every prime number p, but why do I get really integers. On the other hand, I think for the physicists, it may be worth realizing that if these differential equations have a crystalline background, there should be extra symmetries coming from the Frobenius operator. So, and the physicists may wonder, where are these symmetries, these extra symmetries in nature? Okay, so this much for the sort of general philosophy remarks. And I'm going to hide quite a bit of these general things behind the actual example, which I'm, examples I'm going to present now, carry along. And for one thing, I'm going to hide the word crystalline behind the word formal group, formal group law. The advantage being that I can talk about a formal group over the integers, formal group law of the integers, and then have a mechanism which puts all these different pieces in one framework. So synchronizing the piece and hiding that I'm talking about crystalline cohomology is what you, when I talk about the formal group law in this talk, basically that's where the crystalline stuff, all the primes together, is happening, I hope. So, and there was a practical reason I was once invited by Jan de Neff to explain in Leuven, his university, what crystalline cohomology is. In a seminar took 5 hours, and they kept on asking questions, and we continued doing dinner. So today I do not have the time. So that's why I say it's just practical that I hide my crystalline cohomology behind group blocks. So let's try to get used to the group laws. Then the first one is just the line. I also try to get used to the word motive. So one of the realizations of this motive is this picture. On the other hand, other realizations are that you know how to measure distance on this line. And that's closely related to a differential form, dx. And you may ask, what are the symmetries of this differential form? So what's the relation between dx and the z? Between x and z, what's z as a function of x if dx equals dz? Then, as we all know, z should be equal to x plus a constant. Okay, so my second example of this phenomenon, motive, picture is a circle. And, well, you know, you can describe the circle in polar coordinates and you can describe it in Cartesian coordinates. And if I do that in Cartesian coordinates and I start measuring arc length along the circle, that brings all these trigonometric functions, in particular the sine function and its inverse, the arc sine function. And so basically, the arc length is just measuring an angle, which is something new compared to the Cartesian coordinates. And then you can sort of expand this arc sine function in the Taylor series. And you can do it a bit better by normalizing a different way. What you get is a Taylor series, which is sort of important as an important structure. There are denominators, but the denominator at the power x to the 2n, the denominator is just 2n, sorry, x to the power 2n plus 1. The denominator is 2n plus 1. Now the other part of the coefficient is an integer. For good reason, it's binomial coefficient. And the binomials is a very good excuse for all kinds of complicated expressions in the integers to be integers themselves, binomial. So, about this circle, let's also look at it, the arc lengths I said already, but let's look at the differential form. And again, we can ask, what are the symmetries of this differential form? It's not the language you ask to your calculus students, but they can answer this question if you ask them, just solve this differential equation, the separation of variables. And they will come up with, hopefully, with this solution, z is some expression you can read over there, and that's quite difficult for all these things you've been really pointing at the sheets. So you can express z as a power series in x and the constant of integration, so to speak, y. And then this power series has a very good structure. And this power series is what one calls a formal group law. It means that you can actually use it to add. Actually, what it is doing, this formula, is describing how to add two angles in terms of the sine function, the cosine function. And you can make this also in a formal group law over the integers. That means that in this two-parameter variable power series, the coefficients are integers by a bit of descaling. And now the exercise to show that the coefficients are really integers, but you bring them back again, you reduce it to binomial coefficients, where you're sure they're integers. That's a bit more work than it was before. So that's not here. Okay, so that was the circle. Well, there's also the multiplicative proof. And you know there is a relation between the multiplicative proof and the circle. But first, let's look at the multiplicative proof itself. Well, the differential form is dx over x. And if you ask for the symmetries of this differential form, it's telling you that z as a function of x is just x times a constant. The symmetries of the differential form. You can change the coordinates a little bit by shifting the origin so as to have coordinate 0, whereas before it has coordinate 1. So if you shift the origin to have coordinate, if you shift coordinates to have the origin to get coordinate 0, then the group law becomes w is u plus v plus u times v. That's a form of power series in two variables, but not too many terms. But it is a form of power series in two variables. And this is again an example of a form of group law over the integers. Coefficients are all integers. And this one is the standard multiplicative group law. So when you are teaching calculus and all these trigonometric stuff and all these addition laws, nobody can remember without knowing that behind it are just complex exponentials. So if you write out this relation with the complex exponentials, then it becomes an isomorphism between, on the one hand, the multiplicative law, and on the other hand, the addition law for the sine function. And it's very simple, and the best thing is first to pass to the hyperbolic functions, and then from the hyperbolic function to the ordinary exponential, not the complex I, being ix, but being x. And then the end of the story is that the relation between the multiplicative group and the circle is realized by an isomorphism of formal group laws, but the isomorphism involves denominator 2 and it involves complex number I. Okay, so you can just drop scaling a bit, get rid of the 2, and well, I don't know whether you want to get rid of the I by descaling. So, having seen the pictures of the line and the circle, you may like to guess what my next picture would be. So, my next example of a motif is the Landeskart of Bernoulli. And so, there the arc length, the parameterization which gives this formula of the arc length, not on the sheet. The arc length is again given by an integral over a certain differential form. And if you look at this integral and expand it in the Taylor series, well, it's there. And now again you can normalize the variable a bit. So that actually the denominators which really appear are the same as the exponents which appear at a certain spot in the power series expansion. And in front of that expression, there is an integer. Okay. So, from the point of view of differential forms, Euler looked at it. And he asked, basically, what are the symmetries of the differential form? And I don't know, he doesn't say how he did it, just gives the answer and says, you check. Okay, so one can check that if x and z are related by this differential equation, then actually z can be expressed constant of integration y is sort of nicely coming up in this formula. And what you actually get is the first example of an elliptic curve and its addition law. So this was the beginning of this was Euler, who was actually interpreting his way work of Pagnano, and this was the beginning of the theory of elliptic curves. Not quite correctly, because 100 years before that or so, Fermat also looked at this equation of Riemann-Noël, and he was looking at the duplication formula and its inverse. It's processing for descent, and that process would stop. But for our purpose, I am looking at the Euler way, and this is the elliptic curve. Okay, so while coming here, I got 6 hours of bonus, not sleep time where I was supposed to be awake. It was still dark, and so I started thinking about this talk, and I had the impression I was going to understand what I'm saying. And so yesterday morning I wrote up some sheets, extra sheets, and this morning I was still waking up at quite early, and starts thinking about the sheets. And so this is a nice sheet, but it's not quite correct. But let's see what is on the sheet. Later on, Del Pezzo, so we had elliptic curves, later on Del Pezzo will come into the picture. And here's the equation which I found in literature over Del Pezzo surface, which is obtained by blowing up 7 points in projective plane. And now on this sheet I say, well, I can also view this equation as a double cover of the projective plane and then branched along the Fermat quartic curve in the projective plane. And in this projective plane, I also have a family of conics, and I have drawn some of the real pictures of some of these conics. And so this gives a nice foliation of the projective plane, these conics. And if I pull them back to the double cover, I should get a pencil of elliptic curves, and exactly the pencil which I have given there. So that's what I thought yesterday, and then this morning I started to worry if I intersect the curve of degree 4 with the curve of degree 2, it should be 8 intersection points. And if I take a double cover, and I have something with 8 intersection points, 8 branch points, I'm not going to get a little bit curve. So the solution, which also came this morning, is that probably I should have started here, not with w to the power 4, but w squared, giving w not degree 1, weight 1, but weight 2. And then the ambiguity would have disappeared. Okay, so the ambiguity problem of interpreting the thing as an elliptic curve already had disappeared here. If you look at the equation, then it's clearly the equation of a double cover of the projected line branched at 4 points. By a simple shift in the z coordinates, I can give this equation a different appearance. And that's the appearance of this curve I'm going to carry along. Now. So I get now where I'm going to look at elliptic curves. Oh, by the way, in Maser's paper, What's the Motive, the notices of this month, well, between all the things you can read, well, at least, if we do not know what is a motive, we should agree that the curves and their Jacobians, those are motives. So in particular, elliptic curves are motives. So even though I'm just saying elliptic curve, are motives. But on the other hand, I want to be open also for different kinds of geometry. And not in this talk, but if you look in the literature, this equation also comes up in singularity theory, and then it's called a simple elliptic singularity of type E7 triddle. Okay, but as I said, I want to look at it as elliptic curve, and T is a parameter. So I have a family of elliptic curves living in a weighted projective plane, and at certain values of the parameter, they singular finals. Okay, so what do people do with a family of elliptic curves? Well, elliptic curves have periods, and the circle has only one period. The elliptic curve has two periods, has a lattice of rank two, period lattice of rank two. And then you can ask, if you have a concrete equation for an elliptic curve, can you give me at least one concrete period? Okay, and that is the trick to do it, is, well, you start on the second line of this formula. So what you see is an integral over two circles. A circle, let's say, where x and z both have absolute value 1. That you see the equation appearing in the denominator. So this integral calls for the use of the residue theorem, and going from the second to the first line, you apply the residue theorem. And if you teach a course like that, it was a simple pole. You find the derivative of the denominator as the residue, 1 over the derivative as the residue. It also tells you that this mysterious closed curve on the elliptic curve, gamma 0, is actually, while x is just tracing through its unit circle, z, via the equation, is following. And so this what you get is a closed curve on the elliptic curve, so the Riemann surface of the elliptic curve. Okay, so now if you want to get concrete series expansions, then you fiddle around a bit, you apply the just a geometric series expansion, and you find that there's a power series in the variable T inverse, U is the inverse of T, you find this very concrete power series. Power series with integer coefficients. And then there should be a period lattice of rank 2. So where is the second period, or a second period? Well, it's, again, it's an integral with this differential form along a curve. But it's very difficult, I find, to point at concrete curves on this elliptic Riemann surface. But there is a trick. First, I determine this period is a solution of some differential equation. And I find the second solution to this differential equation using the trick found by Frobenius. And that means that we introduce a formal nilpotent variable epsilon. Epsilon is greater than 0. And we write out this series on the right and expand it in top powers of epsilon. And the coefficients we get then is, first of all, the f0 we had before. And there's another coefficient, f1, in form of epsilon, which is the second period we get. Now, the standard thing to do when you have an elliptic curve, you have two of its periods, you take the quotient of the periods, and that is the true modulus, so in the sense of moduli parameter, tau, which is a parameter, in this case, varying in the upper half plane. And then you take Q to be the exponential of tau. So one of the things I always have trouble with is indeed, where is the I here? And one of the things I'm not guaranteeing that's completely correct on this sheet, well, let's see, it's correct on the sheet, but when I say that tau is in the upper half plane, maybe it's in the right half plane, or maybe it's in the left half plane. So I don't know where to put the I. Okay, oh, by the way, one thing to notice is the word, so there was this family of elliptic curves, and the parameter for the family was T, or its inverse U. But now we have, on this parameterizing curve, let's call it moduli space, on the moduli space we have another local coordinate, which namely this U, or better, you take it for the root of U. And this, in the rest of the talk, there will be various new new coordinates on this moduli space. And so this is the first time we see one that's a cube, and let's keep it in mind. Oh. There's a relation here between Q and U. You may want to invert this relation and express U as a function of Q. What you get is, using the Dedekind-Eta function, you get this formula, but let me say, I think the more appealing is to write this for T inverse, and then you get this very nice expression for T, so T, which is U inverse, for T to the 4, you get this expression. And well, some people may want to ask me, is this a Thompson series? I don't know. And let me say, I have enough trouble already in formulating this thing, and I do not want to see the monster right now. So it may be a Thompson series, and maybe that's turn out to be relevant later, but I don't see for the present purpose relevant having Thompson series. So I have these two periods, F0, which had a nice holomorphic expansion starting with 1, and there's F1, which does involve, it was not so clear on the sheet, does involve the logarithm of U. But F0 doesn't. And I integrate F0, and I'm going to present now motifs at various forms, have various realizations. And one of the sort of vague sense motive I'm going into now is I'm integrating again this form F0. And the first time I'm showing this is I'm integrating with respect to U. You can write out the formal power series, the formal power series for that. I may observe that again this has a structure of there are denominators, but the denominator at exponent 4n plus 1, the denominator is also 4n plus 1. The other part of the coefficients is an integer, it's 3. Okay, then it wasn't very transparent in the sheet I had about the addition of the sign, but it did involve the arc sign and its inverse, the sine function. And if I write it more clearly, the L is the analog of the arc sine, and the L inverse, the inverse function, is the analog of the sine. And so when you write it like this, the addition law is coming out just for free. The addition law, which includes associativity. Associativity is coming out for free. What's important is that when you write this power series in two variables, that the coefficients you see then are integers. That can be proved. There's another integral on this function on this sheet. And actually, when I do the same manipulations, that is given to give the addition law of the Landes card, but scaled to an integer form. And then one can prove, and it's well, it's not completely obvious, one can prove that these two addition laws, little L and the big L, they are isomorphic. Isomorphic over, well, you know, if you write equations, you always have some options of choosing coefficients and a sign and so on. So number theorists will say, okay, I'm just building in later on a Dirichlet test. And so if I do compare with the formulas I had before, the Landes card, there is probably an I built in somewhere. And so the isomorphism is not over Z, the isomorphism is also over Z I. So just putting this I in is the same as later on giving an excuse that you're just that you yielding to it. Okay, so that's motives. This talk was about motives and strengths. I don't know what strengths are. I didn't know what motives are, but I definitely know what strengths are. So let's take it as a word which appears on FTH quite often. And now, one of the, I think it doesn't appear on this thing, this paper by Seidlack and Witten, with a for me, very impressive title, which I do not understand the word. That's my fault. So, but I had some reference to this paper, and the reference was that I should actually look at some of the examples in the paper. The first example in that paper, actually, it was dealing after some coordinate, adapting the coordinates. It was actually dealing with the theme, I have my Lambdas card, and its period of zero, and I'm going to integrate this period once. I've done this before, but integrating with respect to the variable u. Now I'm integrating with respect to the variable t, which is 1 over u. Okay, and Seidlack and Witten, they use both periods, f0 and f1. And it's not difficult to compute these two periods, but that seems not really the point for their paper. Physicists are very fond of metrics. And so they formulate their result as having a metric, a new metric, on this moduli space. And this new metric is defined in terms of these quantities A and AD. And this is not just any metric, or this K is the potential of a Taylor metric, but it's not just any metric. This is a Taylor metric. This is a special Taylor metric. And there seem to be two kinds of special Taylor metrics. And this is what they call the rigid version. The rigid version is sort of visible at this formula down here. Well, you can actually express this K in terms of an inner product, omission inner product. What was the title of this function? Was the mirror symmetry the title? Should I talk about the mirror symmetry? So there's a glimpse of mirror symmetry behind this, and that's what I realized while preparing this talk. So I was confused about what is special Taylor geometry. And then I read about rigid and local, and then I should give this side of Britain. But I knew work of Vasily Golishev. And Vasily Golishev is one of the people in Moscow who is trying to understand mirror symmetry for Fano varieties. And Fano varieties in dimension 2 is also called the Delpeche surfaces. So, and he found a very, very nice way of encoding the enumerative properties of the Delpeche surfaces into a very simple matrix. And I think the interpretation of this matrix is that it's giving the notification in quantum cohomology with the anticanonical class of the Delpeche. But of course, the matrix for some linear map also involves kind of choices of bases. And I'm not sure that I'm sure that I cannot say it here because I didn't forget that. So there may be some way, if you say it's multiplication by the anticanonical class, there should be a choice of bases involved to get really this matrix. But the importance of this matrix is that you put it into the formula to make a differential equation. And then when you start solving the differential equation, you'll find the differential equation for 3, and you find the basis of solutions of fundamental matrix And the bottom line of this fundamental matrix does involve the constant function 1 and involves the a and the d, which are also inside the pattern. Okay, so I don't know what the motivation for cyclic rhythm was, but I find it quite interesting to see that other people who are talking about neural symmetry come up with the same series. There is some sort of ambiguity in this. We can make a translation in the T variable, or sort of compensating the translation in the A matrix. And that means that the diagonal entries of A have not a completely intrinsic meaning. But the other numbers in this have. Okay, so also you may wonder, is this just this example? Well, the only thing this example is the cyclic rhythm stuff, because that's the only reference I could find. But I know Bolyshev and his work much better. And he told me that there are actually 6 of these examples, and they all match up with Delpeter surfaces. So, go reading down, it's the degree of Delpeter surface. So that's 9 minus the number of blown up points. So the top entry is we blow up 8 points in P2. The next one is the example of this lecture. The third one is the cubic surface. And so on. The other ones are also quite interesting. And for instance, number 5 is closely related with Apérys' proof for the irrationality of the number taken 2. Okay, so with this sort of differential equations related to these matrices, and if you solve the differential equations and you look at the last coordinate, they involve series. These series have coefficients, and here are these coefficients. So the example of this lecture is number 2. The others are interesting, or even for some people, number 2 is 5 is even more interesting because these are these three numbers. And the remarkable thing is that these numbers, they came out as coefficients in some in the solution of some differential equation, and it's already remarkable that they are integers. But it, actually, these integers, you can also see them as the constant term in the powers of some polynomial. And just to complete my show that I know more than this one example, and to make this complete, polynomials. So you take one of these 6 polynomials, you raise it to the power n, you look at the coefficient of x to the n, y to the n, z to the n, in this nth power p, you get a number which is easy to compute. And that's the number which appears in as coefficient in the holomorphic solution in this mysterious differential equation derived from these mysterious counting matrices for the Delpeter surfaces. Okay, so now let me go back to my running example for this lecture and forming group laws. So that's the place where I hide all the students. So what's the formal group law associated with this situation? So we do the calculation of the power series for A. It looks as if there are denominators. Now but if you look closer, then you can actually look at the complete coefficient, and this complete coefficient is an integer. And the way to prove it is to reduce it again to binomial coefficients and multinomial coefficients, which are the guarantee proof of the images. Okay, I have said already a couple of times I'm using the binomial or multinomial coefficients, so the binomial theorem. And also you can say the binomial theorem is a kind of a motif pattern running through this talk. But I'm not going to be able to quantify that pattern. Okay, so if I look at 1 over A, I get a power series with integer coefficients in U. And this then is the logarithm of a form of Hooke's law of the integers over Z. But this one is itself isomorphic to the additive. Keep in the back of our mind. We have seen first the Hooke law on the moduli space, which is the Hooke law of the Lambda card, isomorphic to it. Now we have another Hooke law, which is isomorphic to the additive law. Okay, physicists are producing all kinds of theories and examples. And now I can. Another paper, actually there are several papers in this topic, by Lerche, Meyer, and Warner. Now here the title is a bit more easier to recognize. The word Alfonso is in the title, and Cyber Britain is in the title. Okay, again, what they are doing, if you look at the example, you strip off many words which you don't understand. I strip off many words which you don't understand. Then it comes down to integrating again the two periods of my Lambda card family. But now I'm integrating not, well, this time I'm integrating with respect to du over u. Okay, good. We'll do that. And then, yeah, this is just the half tradition of. Then defining something which is the peak potential, you'd be surprised that it has integer coefficients and so on. So this is a sheet which I basically replaced by a sheet which I had shown, but on the replacement, the Calabio aspect of that my one is the bottom section of the sheet wasn't copied on the other sheet. So they, in their theory, they say, well, actually what we are doing is performing the standard thing we have learned for the quintic, Calabi-Yau prefold. We are performing the standard thing with the non-compact Calabi-Yau prefold, and that's the equation here. Okay, so they reduce this to just down to the elliptic curves. So reading the paper, it's easy to find out what the methods about these elliptic curves I've been talking about till now. Okay, so then in the physics tradition, they construct a metric on the moduli space, and here's the formula for this metric. And this time, it's again, it's the K is the potential for a Kähler metric, but again, it's a special Kähler metric. But this time of the day called local time, local special Kähler metric. And that's to be viewed as a metric on the space, on the moduli space. Well, here's a sheet which I'm going to show just quickly, is that to convince those people who have worked with the quintic and know all the tricks for the quintic, that that these are exactly the same formulas, and especially the ones in the bottom section here. And I think this formula between K and this omega is already going back to the work of Banderas and Rosa on the special formulas. Okay. So again, this was supposed to be related somehow to Mendelssohn. So, and Lyrica Majorana also were on this game of mirror symmetry. And so they did standard calculations, and they found again an expansion in terms of phi log rhythm, standard type of expansion, with integer coefficients. And they say these integers, they count how many instantons there are of DBS states. And instanton and DBS is a word I do not understand. Because well, in the printing case, you hear the word, it's counting how many rational curves there are. Okay, so but for us, so but this time, so now I have shown when I said integer, I've shown a proof actually that these numbers were integers. This time, the a's come out as being integers, but without a proof. And that's the mystery, why are these things integers? I have been manipulating solutions, differential equations. I don't know whether you can track of what I'm doing, but all of a sudden, when we look at them, they are integers. Okay, so now I'm making a slight move. Well, the formulation, it seems that these integers are coming after I had this prepotential F. I've been working on this prepotential F. But if you look closer at how all these things arise, you can actually bring these numbers back to a relation between the moduli parameter tau of the complex moduli problem and this B, which is a modulus in the setup of Lyrica-Majorana. And you can write it in this, I like this form, but in my form. So there is this Q, little Q, which is the one from the complex moduli problem. And there's a capital Q, which is brought in by this moduli way of looking at moduli problem, the way my back and my one of them. And then you get this this relation. Okay. Come back to this in a minute. Anyway, I have just a few minutes. Back to the field from a group loss. This time, again, in this B, there are integers. But now they come as coefficients before an allowed denominator. And this, actually, the structure of this, and it's easy to prove, it's possible to prove, it's possible to prove, that when I make up this expression for this Q, which is X B, which is the expression you see here, turns out to be a power series in the variable u to the power 4 with integer coefficients. And that means that I can actually formulate this as, again, I'm looking at a formal group law, but this time it's a multiplicative formal group law. And this time it's a version of the multiplicative formal group law in a coordinate system which is not shifted. It's having the unit element coordinate 0, this one would be the unit element is coordinate 1. Okay, so I think I'm hoping that one of the reasons of getting integers everywhere is that now we have in this moduli space various group laws. In particular, there's an additive one coming from the cyclic rhythm theory, and there's a multiplicative one coming from the Lyrica-Majorana way of looking at it. And I hope there is some kind of tension between these two, which creates a reason for all these integers. Just refresh the formula from the A and the B, so the Seiberg written and the Lyrica-Majorana, I can come to U. So if I would have to choose on this, I have four coordinates right now already in the moduli space. If I would have to choose, pick one or two to build a whole theory on, I could forget about you because I can reconstruct that from the beginning. So now there's coming a big twist in the story. So I rewrite my B, the integrals, defining it, and I rewrite it in a particular form. Then this form had been around in completely different areas of mathematics, and it's known as the Mahler measure. And Mahler was not thinking about the strings and so on. Mahler was thinking about big primes. And so there's a Mahler measure for every little Hopwell number. And also, so this one is the two variable version, but of three and more variable versions. And okay, so it turns out that this Q of Larkin-Meyer-Rauner is actually the Mahler measure of polynomial. It basically defines my family of elliptic curves. And then, fairly unexpected, it has been observed by Boyd and other people that there are examples of polynomials define a curve. You compute the Mahler measure, and on the other hand, you compute the L function of this curve. And you compute the value of the derivative of the L function at zero. And then this Mahler measure and this derivative at zero, the L function, they coincide up to a simple rational factor. That's a phenomenon which is completely in agreement with the conjectures of Valenson and also Bloch about how do you treat special values of L functions. There's motifs all over the behind it. And so I find it quite exciting that I see this from a lot of physicists, and it's probably not their main hobby to count, but they do count and they communicate with mathematicians by showing the counts, the tables. And then it's a hobby definitely of the mathematicians who are working on motifs to find out about special values of L functions. And now these two things, they appear quite close, almost alongside in the same examples. So to finish the talk, a long time before I ever heard about strings, I felt the need that I had learned crystalline cohomology, but I had lost an audience. Who can I talk to about crystalline cohomology? So I discovered that it was possible to make some of these crystalline cohomology statements very concrete and communicate with number theorists like Chris Burfus. So, and the result of that is that we, as an application of all this concrete crystalline cohomology business, we computed for certain K3 surfaces with an elliptic pencil on it. We computed the L function, and at the same time, we computed the Picard-Fuchs equation and the solution for this elliptic pencil on the K3 surface. And then we showed there was a very simple relation. Well, this formula is a bit too optimistic. It doesn't really fit this example here. So the idea was to have a family, to have elliptic curves, a family of elliptic curves, on a, in that case it was P2, so let's now say it on Petzl. And we would take a double cover of this P2, this is Petzl, which is branching along two of the singular fibers. And, well, in this example I have here with the Lemnis card, singular fibers are not at zero and infinity, but there's a single fiber at infinity, no other single fibers at 2 or 2 or something. So this square root of u should be adapted for the Bragg formula. But if, in this example, what Wilkins and I found for elliptic, for these K3 surfaces in our examples, if that also applies to this example here, then we would have even a more miraculous thing. It's not the value of null function, but the whole null function, which is sort of appearing in formulas which are very closely related to the physics counts. Okay, so what could be the pattern, the motive behind all this? Well, u is a modular function. F0 as a function of tau is the modular form of weight 1. The derivative of u with respect to tau is the modular form of weight 2. And now we look at all the integrands we have used up till now. Each time we have taken F0 times the differential form made up of u. And all these differential forms have the shape of the weight 3 modular form times d tau. And so this could be sort of the unifying theme, I hope. As I said, this talks on reconstruction, and this is the status of last night. These modular forms of weight 3, when you integrate them, you should integrate them twice, you get Eichler integrals. And these Eichler integrals are known to describe extensions. Except I forgot extension of what, if it's the extension of the modular curve or the extension of the elliptic curve, so that's why I forgot. But it may be that is a common theme is that we should consider extensions. And now we have the Seiberg written version of this extension. We have the Lyapunov-Warner version of the extension. And we have the version that Wilkins and I have. Extension. And all these versions seem to be counting from. Not on these, so not from these papers I decided. No, but probably the additional notification on most universal components in nature. Yeah, I spent quite some time, long time ago, on building in upper form of Hooke's laws and things were, in that sense, for things with additive notification. I think that it's good material additive and multiplicative to now come in. And I do not know any reason why I want to at the moment. Could be. But maybe, after all, elliptic cohomology is also relevant to this, so I do know. Library Peter is one operator. And so one of the things which is still under construction is how can I explain Frobenius operators as quickly as possible to a general audience? And so my reason for mentioning all the time these formal Hooke laws is that in the back of my mind, I think that I should probably replace Frobenius by multiplication by p in the form of Hooke law. So I have this structure on the base, and now on the basis structure and all the primes operating. You know how to multiply with a prime number on the base. It may look awkward in the coordinate you're looking at, but anyway. So instead, so what I'm sort of trying to do is to transfer the Cresselbein story. I would like to transfer the Frobenius from there to actually multiplication by P in the Cooper. That's what I hope by emphasizing each time I have a couple of the set. But I haven't finished the construction.
So just a quick announcement. Lunch is going to be served upstairs in the bistro where you had your coffee break. But for people who are interested in taking the scenic route upstairs, John Matlock here has agreed to give interested parties a tour of the building. So you can meet John down here at the front of the building, or the